Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, along with Steve Goldstein. Checking Valley traffic, the worst problem spot right now appears to be the 60 westbound. A crash at Mill has three lanes blocked. Elsewhere, watch out for crashes. I-10 westbound at 12th Street. I-10 westbound, the Avondale Boulevard exit ramp is restricted. And a crash on the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway at 24th Street. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 92. It's 90 degrees right now. 2 days after Attorney General Mark Brnovich announced 18-year-old Maheen Khan of Tucson pleaded guilty to terrorism charges, a woman has been arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to commit terrorism. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, this will be the second time Brnovich will prosecute a state-level terrorism charge.
Michelle Bastian was taken into custody after agents from the FBI and the AG's office served search warrants Wednesday in Chandler and Florence. In court documents, Bastian is accused of helping her already incarcerated husband, Thomas Bastian, to create an explosive device to kill the prison warden. Mia Garcia is a spokesperson for the Attorney General. She says because Arizona has a strict conspiracy to commit terrorism statute, things can move more quickly in state court.
Our goal is to stop these homegrown terror plots before innocent lives are lost. And this is a new initiative by the FBI in our office. And we are now moving to prosecute some of these cases in state court instead of federal court.
While Garcia could not comment on the case itself, court documents showed that Bastian's husband had converted to Islam and had become radicalized. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's 1st Congressional District is one of the largest in the country, and the seat is open thanks to Representative Ann Kirkpatrick's decision to not run for re-election and instead challenge Senator John McCain. Nationally, Democrats and Republicans are watching the race between Paul Babiou and Tom O'Halloran very closely and are investing a lot of money in the district. KJZZ's Laurel Morales has been following the race closely and joins us with more. Laurel, this is a pretty interesting district. Can you tell us a little bit about its history?
Yeah, Steve. So it's one of the largest districts in the country. It's bigger than the state of Illinois. It stretches from northeastern Arizona along the Utah border down to the outskirts of Tucson. And the Redistricting Commission created it to be a competitive district. It's rural, but very diverse. The district includes several tribal nations. It's actually 25% Native American. It's also comprised of retirees, miners, a college community where I live, and veterans. There is a slight edge to Democrats in this district, but Republicans have held this seat as well.
And the two major party nominees, one is Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babiou, who has had a lot of negative things involved, sort of tossed at him by opposing campaign, by outside groups, some things that some people might describe as scandalous. And Tom O'Halloran has an interesting history himself, having served in the state legislature as a Republican, but also having run as an independent. And this time he's running as a Democrat. So two pretty interesting candidates.
Babiou was headmaster of a school in Massachusetts that has been shut down after the state discovered widespread child abuse. This abuse was apparently happening when he was there, but Babiou has denied any wrongdoing. But his sisters, they're telling people not to vote for him. That was in a recent Washington Post article. Tom O'Halloran, on the other hand, as you mentioned, he was a Republican when he was a state lawmaker, and he switched to being independent. And just before announcing he was running for CD1, he changed to Democrat. While some have called this opportunistic or selling out, O'Halloran says it's a strength, and he says he knows how to work with everybody.
So, Laurel, when we think about O'Halloran and Babiou as actual candidates and what sort of platform they're running on, what are some issues that you can think of that really they're passionate about or that really show the differences between them?
O'Halloran, when he was in the state legislature, he helped a bipartisan group pass all-day kindergarten, university funding, and health care for children of low-income families. He also pushed for more funding for Child Protective Services and Arizona's Medicare program. He is for increasing solar and wind power through government regulations, while Babu has said he wants to deregulate the EPA and fight to keep coal-fired power plants open for jobs and to keep energy costs low. O'Halloran has said he supports most mining as long as it doesn't pollute groundwater. Babu takes a tough on immigration stance. He has pushed for increasing border security, while O'Halloran supports immigration reform that secures the border, but also the DREAM Act, which allows young people who are brought to the country as children to go to college or to join the military.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales with the latest on the congressional race in Arizona's first congressional district. Early voting started in Arizona yesterday. And Laurel, thanks so much for the time.
You're welcome, Steve.
Ballots will be in voters' mailboxes in the next few days, and early voting is already underway in Arizona. The increase in the number of Arizonans who cast their ballots before Election Day has forced campaigns to adapt to a changing calendar, and today we'll have two perspectives on that. We start with political consultant Constantine Carrard, who's running a number of races for conservative legislative candidates this cycle, among other elections. And Constantine, how have things changed for you as more and more Arizonans vote early?
Well, now Election Day, or as we call it, October, is sort of this long 4-week process. So the old way, you had everything geared towards identifying and turning out your voters on a specific day. So I can remember, you know, part of calling voters in the weeks leading up to Election Day, we were trying to find out if they needed a ride to the polls. So you'd get volunteers who had vehicles who could drive people to the polls, because if they had somebody that was elderly or didn't travel well or needed extra time, just the act of getting people to the polls was a big part of turning out your vote. Obviously, that's all changed now. We have the early ballots that people get at their house. And so now we're chasing voters for 4 weeks saying, have you voted yet? Get your ballot in. And it means that the process to a degree gets longer, because instead of gearing up for 3 or 4 weeks before Election Day and making that strong push for those 3 or 4 days before, you gear up a couple of weeks before the start of early balloting, and then you push hard for 4 weeks.
During those 4 weeks, though, does it make it easier for campaigns in the sense that you can ask voters, have you voted, and then you can actually find out whether or not they have, as opposed to having to continue to call them or knock on their door and remind them to vote on a particular day?
I suppose it's easier in that you have several chances to get the person to vote. If somebody happens to miss Election Day under the old system, you'd have lost that vote, whereas now you have a longer period of time to chase and to turn out your vote. The ability to find out who has voted really varies by county. To a certain degree, if there's a negative effect, it's that people tend to vote early, you know, 3 weeks before Election Day, and then something happens 2 weeks before Election Day that changes their mind.
Yeah, I'm curious about this idea. You know, we hear so much about the, quote, October surprise. Does that play less of a role now since some folks are voting at the beginning of October and not waiting around till closer to Election Day to see what happens?
It shifts the surprises into September. October surprises are never accidentally or coincidentally in October. You know, Election Day is still the big day. You have more votes cast on Election Day than any other time. And so for a national race, let's say you're running for president, some states have early balloting, some don't, which means the so-called October surprise will still come closer to the November Election Day, which is later in our process. But, you know, 30 or 40% of the votes could have already been cast when news breaks about something. And then those voters don't have a chance to change their mind. They've already cast their ballots.
How do you advise the candidates with whom you work about how to work on their messaging over that time from when early ballots go out to Election Day?
I think it's important for them to know that it is a marathon and not a sprint, that they need to kind of stay focused day after day after day.
Political consultant Constantine Carrard. For another perspective, I'm joined by Stacey Pearson, also a political consultant. She's running Democrat Paul Penzone's race for Maricopa County Sheriff this year. And Stacey, let me start with the same question. In your mind, how has running a campaign changed as more voters are casting their ballots early?
Well, the biggest change is the target date on the calendar. The calendar on the wall, there are two dates that are circled. One was yesterday, and one is November 8th. So when voting starts and when voting ends, there are two target dates.
How do you try to message leading up to those different dates? How do you try to target and talk to potential voters leading up to those two potential dates?
It's an exact science, quite honestly. You take a look at folks who are on the permanent early voting list, and you take a look at their behaviors and whether or not they've voted in the past. And if they voted in off years, if they've only voted in presidential elections, if they are registered Democrats, if they're independents, did they change their registration recently? Did they not change their registration recently? Have they moved? You really start to dig down into folks' voter files and try to get a good sense of who they are and what they're planning to do. And you start to build a list of those very people, and you start to target them, both with digital ads, with television ads, with radio ads. You try to take a look at whether or not they are concert goers, whether or not they've donated to different nonprofit causes. Do they own a pet? Do they have children? Are they active in their PTA? You really try to get a sense of who the folks are behind the actual name and voter ID.
It sounds like having this longer period of when folks are voting has necessarily made campaigns more data intensive.
Very much so. It really changed the way we look at our target audience and what used to be more of a shotgun approach. So you put up billboards or you put up kind of traditional advertising approaches, and it really switched to individualized advertising.
I would imagine that having social media and other sort of web-based advertising really helps in that endeavor.
It does. What used to be a very television broadcast heavy sport has really turned into more of a digital world.
Obviously, you're running a down-ballot race in a presidential year. Does the fact that so many folks are voting over the course of several weeks affect how many of them get down the ballot as opposed to folks who just show up on election day? Like, if you're sitting at your kitchen table, do you find that people are more likely to take the time, maybe over a couple of days, to get through the entire ballot as opposed to trying to rush to do it, you know, at a polling place?
I think, given the information that's available on judges and folks, not necessarily even just our race, a county sheriff's race or a county recorder's race, but really getting down into some of the farthest down ballot races, folks most certainly are becoming more informed voters, and they're taking their time and they're doing their research and they're checking social media and they're seeing who has endorsed and who has not, and being more thoughtful about what they're doing with such an important tool in their hand, which is their ballot.
Political consultant Stacy Pearson.
As Arizona's U.S. Senate race enters its final stretch, Ann Kirkpatrick is digging in with her attacks on John McCain over his previous support of Donald Trump. The Democrat feels she now has the momentum and the state's changing demographics on her side as early voting begins around the state. The Congresswoman from Flagstaff sat down with KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
Welcome, Congresswoman. Good to have you here.
Phil, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
As far as Senator McCain is concerned, with the age issue, he's now 80. Kelly Ward, who is opponent in the Republican primary, tried to sort of use that against him. You really haven't gone there yet, but you have talked about how his 33 years in Congress have changed him. Is his age at age 80 an issue?
I don't think it's an issue. I think it's more an issue that he's out of touch with Arizona. You know, I have 7 district offices in my congressional district. John McCain represents the whole state, and he only has 3 offices. I just think he's out of touch with Arizona's. But I will tell you, the number one thing I hear about John McCain, regardless of party, people tell me they can't believe he didn't stand up for himself when Donald Trump insulted him. And they're just saying, you know, if he won't stand up for himself, he won't stand up for us. And he's changed.
How do you beat a guy, and I'll even paraphrase the question from Billy on our Facebook page, who says, how do you beat John McCain? He's never lost an AZ election. It seems almost an insurmountable thing. Billy's question, how do you beat him?
He's very vulnerable this cycle. When I decided to get into the race, he was the least liked senator in his home state in the whole country. And, you know, you just think about it. When you look at the primary results, yes, he beat Kelly Ward. But if you combine all the voters who did not vote for John McCain, it's almost 49% of the Republican voters who showed up for the primary. And, you know, I've been traveling all over the district, letting people know they have a real choice and that it's time for new principled leadership in Arizona.
And we did ask our listeners to provide some questions for you in advance of this interview, and we did get a few people. We heard from Billy. Ryan on Twitter says, during the year of Trump, do you think it's possible to turn Arizona blue? How do you possibly make that drastic change in 4 years?
There is a path to turning Arizona blue. And Ryan, I've turned two congressional districts from red to blue. And probably the best example is the 2014 race. In my congressional district, which is just about half the state of Arizona, goes from the Utah border down to the Cochise County line. We boosted turnout for the election 10 points over the rest of the state. So not only did I win in 2014, I expanded my win margin over 2012, and statewide Democrats won my congressional district. So the folks are there. You just have to make sure that they get to the polls and that their ballots count. So we saw what happened here in Maricopa County in March with the presidential preference primary. So a party to the lawsuit against the election officials to make sure that there are sufficient polling places, ballot boxes, and that the ballots get counted.
Congresswoman Kirkpatrick, let's just discuss a little bit about the ballot initiatives that all Arizonans are going to vote on, along with your Senate race with John McCain. First, in Monday's debate, you said you were for Proposition 206. That's the measure that raises the minimum wage to $12 an hour. Our Arizona businesses, particularly restaurants, say this is going to hurt them, force them to raise prices and fire workers instead. Can you empathize with them?
You know, after I graduated from Blue Ridge High School, I worked as a waitress in the White Mountains. So I've worked for hourly wage, and you know, it's tough to make it. Right now in Arizona, it's $8.05 an hour. Families just can't support themselves. I don't think anybody who works 40 hours a week should be living in poverty. I do support Proposition 206, which incrementally raises the minimum wage. And I'm also a small business owner. I ran my own law firm in Flagstaff. And, you know, if you do it incrementally, that gives businesses time to adjust. I actually favor the minimum wage being $15 an hour. But starting with Proposition is a good place to start.
And then Proposition 205, this is the initiative to regulate marijuana like alcohol, essentially making pot legal for recreational purposes in Arizona. The Arizona Democratic Party says vote yes. What about you?
I'm not there. I am opposed to that Proposition 205. I'm a former prosecutor. I have some real concerns about safety. I have some real concerns about children. So I'm opposed to it.
Adrian sends us an email on this very topic and asks, how many of our elected officials have a medical marijuana card? How many of their families and friends have one as well? So as far as medical marijuana, that's okay?
You know, I didn't vote for it, I'll be honest with you. But, you know, Arizona voters approved medical marijuana 3 times. And so I'll listen to the will of the voters. I don't honestly know anyone who has a medical marijuana card.
All right, so there you go. Thanks for that question, Adrian. Carl sent us an email on another topic, Obamacare. He says that it's not perfect. You're still proudest of your vote for Obamacare in Congress, as you've said. But have you released specific plans to fix it, Carl says. Specifically, what bills have you introduced in the House to try and fix Obamacare?
Yeah, I've got a bill ready to be introduced as soon as we go back that forces CMS to expand the insurance carriers in the marketplace. So we've had a real concern about that for some time. When I found out that there might be a shortage in Arizona months ago, I contacted the director and said, we need a plan to prevent this. And then I started working on legislation that I'll introduce as soon as I get back to Congress after the election. But, you know, I come to this whole experience with over 20 years as a hospital attorney. In my private practice, I represented Flagstaff Medical Center. and their umbrella agency. They actually had three hospitals, one in Sedona, one in the Verde Valley. So I have that kind of experience, knowing how difficult it is to run a medical practice. And, you know, I have some ideas about how to streamline this whole process and make it more cost effective.
Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick, good luck. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
When Phoenix's Metro Center Mall opened in 1973, it was believed to be the first mall west of the Mississippi River to have five department stores. Today, just two remain open, and the mall, located just off I-17 and Dunlap, sits in the middle of a city-designated blight area. But as Christina Estes reports from the KJZZ Business Desk, a major makeover is in the works.
I have pictures of me and Santa Claus in this mall. I remember the ice skating rink.
Growing up, Heather Perez spent a lot of weekends here, both in and outside the mall.
When I was in high school, we used to cruise Metro Center.
Today, there's little traffic around the Metro Center loop. Most of the cruising can be found indoors.
The older people, they come and walk. It's like their exercise, so now it's like an indoor track.
Well, this is called a food court, so we're kind of like in the middle of the food court.
The food court didn't exist when Lou Snow moved into the first subdivision built near Metro Center, but there was an airline-themed restaurant.
It was like American Airlines, and what it was the outer shell of an airplane. And you walked in and you had seating right there, just like you're sitting in an airplane.
Remember, this was in the 70s when commercial flying was viewed as fun, even glamorous. People traveled from Tucson and Flagstaff to spend a day at Metro Center. So how did one of the nation's most vibrant retail centers end up in the middle of an area the city labeled as blight?
It really started to have problems as some of the department stores throughout the nation were consolidating. Various department stores went out of business.
Warren Fink is with Carlisle Development Group, the company that now owns Metro Center. He says sales also dropped as newer malls opened and online shopping soared. When the mall's previous owner invested more than $30 million in renovations, neighbors like Lou Snow were thrilled.
I mean, they completely redid all this where we're sitting. All the entrances were changed. They did a tremendous amount.
But that was in 2007, just as we entered the Great Recession. Stores couldn't pay rent, the owner couldn't cover the mortgage, and Metro Center went into receivership. Then in 2012, Fink's company bought it.
Because we were able to buy the project at cents on the dollar.
They paid $12.5 million with the expectation of making a lot more by demolishing the cultural icon, either by knocking down the entire mall or keeping the department stores and gutting most of the walls in between.
Oh, that's sad.
Heather Perez doesn't want to see her childhood mall disappear, but admits,
I guess times change.
The latest buzzwords among developers are open villages and live, work, and play environments. Fink convinced the city council to change the zoning from retail only to also allow office, medical, and residential. It'll take years, but he envisions a mix of senior housing and medical centers, millennial renters, and a 10 to 15 story office building. He says the city's plan to extend light rail to Metro Center is a bonus.
We have the highest density of all of Phoenix in a 5-mile area, and we have almost 500,000 people in that area.
It's an area full of what he calls Walmart customers.
You know, this is not going to be, you know, Gucci Prada. This is going to be, you know, really Main Street America.
A Walmart supercenter is being built on the site of a former department store. It's the first deal since Fink's group bought Metro Center. It doesn't impress Lou Snow, though, who's seen more crime and lower property values over the years. He's not a fan of rentals and worries about who will move in.
Are they going to take on responsibility as a tenant, or are they going to be here today and gone tomorrow? Because that's what you see around here.
But just across the mall's parking lot, car wash owner Nabil Kamoun is excited.
This will bring a lot of traffic.
In the past few years, a string of restaurants have opened near the mall, and the developer noticed.
Those are just not Walmart customers. All we had to do is take a look at the expansion of and success of the restaurants that are around us to realize that this is a much more diverse market than some people think.
While much remains uncertain, Fink says three things are clear. Today's mall will not stay, and yesterday's mall will not return. But here's something both Snow and Perez like.
Still be Metro Center.
That's right. The developer promises the name will stay.
And it better have a round circle, too, because that's where we cruised around in the circle.
The Metro Center Loop, that's staying, too. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Members of a committee set up by the Arizona Board of Regents to help find the next president for the U of A had its first meeting today. Becky Palick of the Arizona Daily Star was there covering it, and she joins me. And Becky, what did we learn from today's meeting?
The search committee is really big. It has 27 members, so the group spent a lot of time today just getting to know each other and talking about their individual and collective ideas about what qualities the next president should have.
What kinds of things are they looking for in the next U of A president?
So one of the regents joked that who they're looking for is actually God on a good day. But this group has to balance the needs of students, faculty, athletics, alumni, a ton of different interest groups. So there's a lot of different traits they hope the new president will have. A couple of common themes where they want someone who's an innovator, who can take charge of the changing reality of university finances, and someone who's a uniter, someone who can bring everyone together and move forward.
Are they perhaps putting more emphasis on things like that because of how President Hart is leaving her position and sort of the controversy that has surrounded her during part of it?
Yeah, there have been a couple of lingering issues with President Hart. So one is that she was on the board of a for-profit university, which stirred up a lot of different feelings here in Tucson and on campus. And also that she just hasn't been seen as someone who can really bring people together.
Did the members of the committee get a sense of against whom they will be competing for the person who will take this job?
Definitely. They talked about how it's a really competitive job market for university presidents right now. There might be as many as 50 job openings at colleges with at least 5,000 students. And they talked about how the U of A could be competing with schools like Duke and Cornell to attract the best candidates.
So how does a school like U of A compete with schools like those?
They want to focus on how the University of Arizona is a top-notch science institution. So they're going to be looking for someone who, if they're not a scientist, that they have experience in some kind of science leadership position.
What's the next step? I mean, this is obviously not resolved today. Do we have a sense of when they might like to have some candidates and start doing some interviews?
The search committee's job is to decide which applicants will advance to the interview stage and then to give the regents advice on who should be considered a finalist. So to help them in that effort, they've hired a search consultant, and he will put together a pool of qualified applicants. Later, once they've gone through that process, once the regents make a final decision, the new University of Arizona president could start as early as next summer.
Becky Palick is a reporter with the Arizona Daily Star. We are talking about this morning's first meeting of the University of Arizona Presidential Search Advisory Committee.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
And I'm playing violin for Rosie Salas Mariachi. The song we were playing was Canción Mexicana. It's a ranchera.
Two, one. Two, ready, go.
Because they're really good songs, I don't really get tired of them, so when I get home, I usually end up going through my favorite pieces and listening to them on YouTube or listening to songs by different artists.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Ready? Breathe in.
It's mostly made for, like, dancing and parties, like if there's a quinceañera or a wedding. So that's what I really like, because it brings a lot of joy.
That's Angela Garcia practicing with the student mariachi ensemble. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to trumpet our success, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. Wells Fargo announced yesterday that co-chairman and chief executive John Stumpf would be stepping down from the bank in response to its sales tactics scandal, which resulted in the opening of as many as 2 million accounts without customers' knowledge.
The board had already decided it would claw back $41 million from Stumpf, but it's uncertain whether he'll face any future punishment now that he's departed the company.
President and Chief Operating Officer Timothy Sloan will assume Stumpf's role. Sheila Kohatkar is staff writer at The New Yorker, covering the unexpected announcement of Stumpf's resignation.
I think a lot of people will be heartened to see that something big has happened. Somebody has lost their job. However, I don't think it really solves the bank's problems because, you know, we know there are a number of investigations going on. The Department of Justice is investigating. They are appointing someone who's been at the bank for more than 20 years, Sloan, to take over. So although he is not from the retail banking division, Mr. Sloan does not represent sort of a fresh new face in the corridors of the bank. And, you know, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. You know, who knew what? How much did the executives know about what these lower level employees were doing, opening these unauthorized accounts? Were they being pressured to do it? Were they punished for trying to complain about it? These are all things that the bank is still going to need to answer for.
I think this whole strategy of opening ghost accounts and having them charge fees to people who don't look at those statements closely, this is the zone that I think is really frightening in the financial industry right now because there's so much fine print. I mean, Charles Schwab could be doing this. Vanguard could be doing this. I mean, any number of people could be doing this. How easy is it? Apparently very easy to flick on switches that mean suddenly you have a different account.
Well, I think it's I think we're going to see more scandals like this in the future. I mean, really, after the financial crisis and the Dodd-Frank reform legislation was passed, a lot of banks had to sort of pull back on riskier activities that they were engaged in to make money, like trading.
Yeah.
So many banks have kind of turned instead to consumers as a way to make money. And we've seen a number of stories over the last few years about fees. You know, suddenly there all these new fees pop up. It sort of reminds me of the airline industry, where now they're charging for things they never used to charge for. Overdraft fees have gone up. A lot of sort of harsh penalties for lower income bank customers who, you know, don't have a high balance in their account. So that kind of thing has happened. I think it's actually really easy to open an account in someone else's name. I mean, we've seen now a lot of firsthand accounts of Wells Fargo employees over the last few weeks. And it sounds like, yes, it was extremely easy. Their colleagues could see that they were doing it. And as one sort of bank executive told me when I was reporting on this, you know, if you give people incentives to open accounts, they're going to open accounts. I mean, it's a pretty simple equation.
If banking is shifting to this fee world, the regulations are different, right? I mean, there aren't protections that, I mean, I'm trying to imagine a regulation that would prevent me from having an account opened in my name that I didn't like sign or put some blood in a little vial or something. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it is very clearly a fraudulent thing to do,
yeah,
to open an account on behalf of a customer who has not requested it. But this is the reason that Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has really had a very prominent voice in this whole thing, that's the reason that she argued for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And that is the reason that that bureau kind of came into being. She sort of said, listen, there's no entity in Washington that is looking out for the everyday person, average customers of the financial industry. We are all entangled with it. If you have a credit card, if you get direct deposit, if you want to buy a house, you are a bank customer. It's sort of unavoidable. So that's why that CFPB exists.
And it does look at every fee.
That's part
mission.
Of what it's
yeah.
supposed to do. Right. It's supposed to be looking for predatory, fraudulent fees, exploitative fees. And it's interesting to note that there is a fight going on in Washington still about the existence of that bureau. There's been a lot of lobbying from the banking industry against it. There was just a sort of an appeals court decision in the last few days that issued a bit of a blow and sort of suggested that perhaps in the future a president could just fire the head of the CFPB, which would jeopardize its financial independence. But this Wells Fargo scandal has sort of played a helpful role.
Game.
Well, that's it. I mean, suddenly everyone's paying attention to this. Maybe we actually do need a bureau like this because clearly this was going on a wide scale. And I think we should expect to see other stories coming out about other companies.
If the Nobel Prize for Literature winner Bob Dylan were to write a song about this, You couldn't get much more dramatic than John Stumpf's testimony when he originally went in there. Take us back to when he went in there, sort of hat in hand, looking very humble. We're trying to do the right thing. And what a bunch of malarkey.
Well, it's really, he's not looking very good right now. It's true. I mean, that testimony, he testified twice.
Yeah.
It was stunning because I think he really believed, or one got the sense that he really expected to just go in there and say, "I'm sorry, we didn't know," and just
"I've got
nothing
this covered,
to see
folks."
Here.
That was his whole demeanor.
Move right along. Everything's fine. We're going to stay. We're going to keep our money. And, you know, it was very interesting to see Elizabeth Warren questioning him because she was very, very blunt. And she said, "You should be investigated by the Department of Justice. You should give back every penny you made while this was going on. And you should resign." And in fact, you know, after the news came out yesterday that he was stepping down, I think she issued a statement saying, "Okay, one out of three. What about the other two?"
Statement and a T-shirt, Elizabeth Warren. Those words went down in history. Sheila Kolhatkar is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Late last month, a coalition of Latino conservation organizations went to Washington in support of the Greater Grand Canyon National Heritage Monument. It's a movement to bring more diversity in the use and leadership of the parks. Jose Gonzalez is the founder of Latino Outdoors, one of the key organizing groups. The show's Naomi Gingold spoke with him about this Greater Grand Canyon initiative and asked him about what kinds of changes he's hoping for.
Some people, you know, may think, well, Grand Canyon is a national park, right? It's protected, it's good to go. But a lot of times we have to remember that an ecosystem is greater than often the boundaries that we put around a space. The land around the Grand Canyon is public land, but it doesn't come with the same level of protections that a national park has. That's mean that it's subject to, for example, energy development, so mining.
Why was it important that Latino groups went to Washington and said this is important? How did that come about?
Usually when we think of the conservation movement, it tends to be a pretty limited demographic. Usually we think about someone that might be middle class, a predominantly Caucasian, because that has been the conservation leadership. And even as I got more inclusive with gender, with like Rachel Carson, we tend to leave out the communities of color. And we saw the opportunity to say, what does our voice look like collectively, unified? Here we are, and this is the way in which the issues are framed through our voice.
Your organization is Latino Outdoors. What exactly does your organization do?
You know, at the beginning, I decided to just start it as an idea, to put my story out there and see will others go ahead and identify with that. So the purpose, you know, we really were looking around kind of three things. One is just to get more families and communities outdoors. And second was, you know, how did we connect as a community? So for me, it was to be able to open up that platform to say, do you want to be a part of this? Then let's do this together. And we don't say, oh, you have to be Latino. It's a certain way in which you have to identify as a Latino. You can be of any background or community and join us. We just knew that we wanted to have work and conversation around this, because we know it's a question of equity and access.
There have been reports looking at use of public lands by different groups, and the use of public lands by Latinos has often been small in comparison to, say, the white population. Do you say that you're seeing that because of inequitable access, or is it that people aren't aware of what's available, or are there other factors at play?
Many communities do not access public lands because of a lack of resources. The biggest barrier might be a perception of being unwelcome. And that might be because a lot of the federal agencies that are not representative of the communities. The question isn't Latinos are new and how do we get them interested, but how have they been a part of this history and we've neglected to highlight those roots, which could be helping us to develop the better connections with new communities.
You said earlier, you know, when you started your organization that you were looking for people like you. Like my story, and I wanted to know, well, what is your story?
I was born in Mexico. I grew up in California in the Central Valley, and I grew up to, you know, love the outdoors. And how the outdoor culture is understood in the mainstream here wasn't something that I saw in my own family.
What do you mean? The whole, like, let's go out and, like, go hiking, that kind of thing wasn't...
Right. You know, let's go to REI and make sure we have all the gear. Let's go set up a tent and camp this weekend. It didn't mean that we didn't go outdoors. I went fishing with my dad and with my uncle to the nearby river, and I didn't know it was a wildlife refuge.
Well, Jose Gonzalez, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
No, most welcome.
Jose Gonzalez is with Latino Outdoors, and that was the show's Naomi Gingold. There's a new world's biggest radio telescope, and it was designed by and built in China. The 500-meter telescope, called FAST, is bigger than the one at Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. To get a sense of why size matters in this area and what this new radio telescope might find, I'm joined by Mike Nolan. He's science team chief for the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft mission at the University of Arizona. He's also the former director of the Arecibo Observatory. And Mike, how big of a deal is this new telescope?
So radio astronomy, which is what these people are doing, is a field where there's only a few facilities that do it. And so it's important that we do get new blood and new people doing new things. As things age, we do need new facilities to do new things and to drive people to be thinking about new and different problems and what can be done better.
How are these kinds of telescopes, these large radio telescopes, how are they different than the kinds of telescopes you might see at like Kitt Peak or Lowell Observatory, a place like that?
Okay, so these are radio telescopes. There are two what we call windows in the Earth's atmosphere that you can see light through. One is the visible spectrum that we're used to looking through, and the other one is the radio spectrum, radio waves. And so those are the two main regions in which we study the universe. It turns out that this new FAST telescope and also the Arecibo Observatory that it's sort of based on, the main thing they do is they look at hydrogen out in the universe. Hydrogen makes up most of everything we can see. So that's the best way to sort of measure how much is out there, what it's doing, look at how galaxies form and that sort of thing.
Well, what will this telescope be able to do and potentially detect that the one in Puerto Rico can't?
Well, it's about twice as big for practical purposes, and so it will be twice as sensitive, and that means it can do things twice as fast, and it can look a little farther away. Just because it can see fainter things. It also turns out it has a wider field of view. Arecibo Observatory can look about 20 degrees from straight overhead, and the new telescope that's being built in China or just being finished in China has a wider field of view, so it'll be able to look at a larger piece of the sky, and that's certainly a good thing.
What kinds of things would you expect that this new telescope might find?
When you build a new telescope, you start off studying the things you know about, and then you find new things to go and do. And we don't know those yet because it's really just getting going. What they're going to be looking at it first, again, is hydrogen in galaxies, how galaxies formed, looking back older towards the beginning of the universe. The other thing that's gotten to be a big thing right now is what we call pulsars, which are exploded dead stars, but they provide very powerful radio waves, which turn out to be very good clocks, that you can measure them very precisely. And that turns out to be important if you want to measure gravity waves.
Does this strike you as maybe the beginning, or maybe we're in the midst of sort of like a telescopic arms race where countries and other groups maybe are really racing to build the biggest, most sensitive telescope to really look as far out into the universe as they can?
I think certainly the Chinese want to do this. They're considering this a prototype, that if this all works out the way they'd like it to, they would like to build some more and really have the most sensitive radio telescopes in the world. I think to some extent what they're doing is, as we all know, that a lot of the stuff we buy is made in China but designed in the United States. And so they wanted to say, this is something that's designed in China, built in China, it's ours. And we want to be major players in that field.
Is this a way, do you think, for China to really become a major player in the space field?
It's a way for them to show that they can do things without having not just being shown what to do.
With this extra layer of sensitivity and the depth that you can see with this new telescope as opposed to prior ones, what do you think that we could learn that will be helpful to us here on Earth from all this?
Well, astronomy is one of those things where it's difficult to make those sorts of predictions. It's very much, you know, where did we come from kind of science, more than how are we going to practically do this kind of science. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't interact. For example, a lot of the technology in cell phones, a lot of that stuff comes from building radio telescope receivers and saying, how well can I make this, and finding good ways to do it. So in the process of doing the science, we often discover we've learned how to do other things. any kind of exploration science is that way, that you're exploring, and so you don't really know quite what you're going to find. And so since you don't quite know what you're going to find, it's hard to know really what you're going to use it for.
Mike Nolan is science team chief for the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft mission at the University of Arizona and former director of the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. We were talking about the new world's largest radio telescope in China.
Serious illnesses can come at any time and affect different people in various ways, often depending upon when they're diagnosed. But how often does true recovery occur, and what factors make that possible? Dr. Michael Hewitt of Canyon Ranch in Tucson had a traditionally healthy lifestyle and had never been a smoker, but then he was told he had stage 2 lung cancer. Hewitt says he was able to bounce back quicker than most thanks to resilience, and he joins me now to talk about that. You were stunned by the diagnosis. You had surgery to remove part of your lung, but then you were pretty much ready to go. Can you take it from there?
The nurses said when I got out of the ICU, said, if you feel up, we'd like you to walk. And I said, all right, I'm on it. So the first night I walked 2.5 miles, and the nurses said, what are you doing? I said, walking. They said, most of our patients shuffle slowly to the nurse's station, catch their breath for 30 minutes and shuffle back to bed, not laps around the building. I said, well, I'm staying on the floor and I'm not doing laps around the building, but it's okay to do laps, isn't it? They said, well, yes, but no running. The fun part, of course, is that when they release you from the hospital, they always pull up a wheelchair. And I have this superstition about wheelchairs. I don't think you should sit in one unless you absolutely need it. So I said, what's that for? And they said, we're releasing you. And I said, you're going to wheel me down to that dark door down at the end of the hallway? And they said, yes. I said, I've walked past that doorway 120 times in the last 2 nights, and you were delighted. And now you tell me I have to wheel down there? I said, no, I'm not doing it. I said, you can release me or you can keep me, but I'm not getting in that wheelchair. And they hemmed and hawed and finally said, well, okay, but don't tell anyone. And here I am telling your entire audience. So my apologies to the nurses. It was a completely different kind of an outcome that many patients have, because I went into the process with quite a bit of resilience.
When you're saying resilience in this case, how do you define it?
Well, there's lots of kind of resilience. I mean, we certainly know about emotional resilience and even social and spiritual and financial resilience. But physiologic resilience is a function of your cardio conditioning, your muscle mass and your strength, your impacted by nutrition and sleep. I talk about a four-legged platform of health. And it's really preventative medicine, but it's resilience as well. And the four legs are really mom's medicine. What did mom tell you? Eat your vegetables, nutrition. That's a component of resilience. She said, go out and play. Physical activity, a component of physiologic resilience. She undoubtedly said, do your homework first. In my case, don't date that girl, although I think that was for her stress management. Stress management is the third leg. And finally, every mom says, get to bed. And I believe those four legs, nutrition and physical activity, stress management, sleep, form the platform your vitality, your longevity, and truly your resilience rest upon. If you've got a good solid base, when the bad thing happens, you can handle it.
When you're someone who has practiced what you called mom's medicine before, and then you get lung cancer and seems like an odd candidate to have lung cancer, did that make you, I don't want to say you went into a spiral of doubt or anything, but did you start questioning any of your preventive methods? Did you say to yourself, well, I didn't do all these bad things, and yet I still got this lousy disease?
Absolutely, that's correct. I started my professional career in Minneapolis doing cardiac rehabilitation. It's great work, but I worked with the patients after their bypass surgery, after their heart attacks. I trained for 6 years to do that. I did it for 6 weeks. I finally decided after 6 weeks, this is so backwards. Why are people coming to me after their bypass surgery, after their heart attacks to rehabilitate the weakened heart muscles? Why didn't we do this exercise together before? And I started to think of it not as cardiac rehab, but as cardiac prehab. And I realized that, okay, maybe preventative medicine didn't work in my case, but preventative medicine, the very same foundations, gave me the resilience so that I could approach this illness at a different level than someone who hadn't done that. I had this solid foundation, and I wasn't going to let this kill me. I wasn't even going to let it make me unable to do the things I love to do.
Michael Hewitt is Research Director for Exercise Physiology at Canyon Ranch in Tucson. We've been talking about how physical and mental resilience helped him recover from lung cancer.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.